B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Thursday, August 30th, 2018. Your humble host issues deep apologies for being offline for the last 8 or 9 days. We've been busy remodeling the secret studio here. And as I speak, the wallboard is in place. I've inhaled quite a bit of gypsum dust in the last few days. Next is a paint job, some carpeting, and then we're going to upgrade the electronics here. It is a work in progress. And our acoustics aren't perfect today, but there is so much that I need to catch up on that I hope you will adjust to the conditions that we have right now. So, in the last 24 hours, Donald Trump has identified something that I narrowly agree with him on, and that is Google search and social media sites like Facebook and Twitter are biased. Now, Trump believes they're biased against him, and we'll dig into the news account that Fox News featured that caused him to tweet about how rigged Google is against conservatives. His tweet said that 96% of the results for searches using the words Trump news came from national left-wing media. Google and others are suppressing voices of conservatives and hiding information and news that is good, he asserts. Well, Kara Swisher at the New York Times quoted one social media executive saying, "For one set, we can't take enough stuff down. For another, we can't leave enough up. One side thinks social media enabled populism, while the other thinks the opposite. There will be no fixing this." And on that, I generally agree. And the woman who wrote the piece that was picked up by Fox that led to Trump's tirade is named Paula Bolyard, and she put an op-ed into the Washington Post. She's an editor at the conservative online outlet PJ Media. And she said, well, while suspicions about inherent biases being baked into the systems at Google and other tech platforms are certainly warranted, I don't believe that government regulations are the answer to that problem. In my article, she says, I reported that 96 out of 100 results returned were from left-leaning news outlets. In fact, nearly a quarter were from CNN. And she used the standards of right-wing former CBS News reporter Cheryl Atkinson, who is a complicated figure. She is quite conservative, and I don't agree with her views. And at the same time, CBS suppressed some of her reporting, and I never support that. At any rate, the details here were then picked up by Lou Dobbs on his Fox Business show, and he took the 96% figure and ran with it, calling for an investigation into the rigged search results. And she says, as a conservative who tends to be rather libertarian on tech issues, I disagree. Now, she is sympathetic to the idea that conservative voices are being silenced or suppressed online. So that's the origin of this. And I find it really, well, hard to swallow, because we have known for over a year that in the effort to crack down on so-called fake news, that Google in particular has tweaked its algorithms to reduce search results that feature lefty outlets like the World Socialist website, Consortium News, Truth Out, Truth Dig, and yours truly here at peterbcollins.com. And in a recent article by Kevin Reed at the World Socialist website, they recap the reporting from last year, proving that changes to Google search algorithms that promote authoritative news sources were suppressing left-wing, socialist, and anti-war websites. And the article notes that the information comes from an IT firm with close ties to the U.S. State Department and Wall Street. It's managed by former military intelligence and law enforcement officers. We're talking about FireEye. And it's capital F-I-R-E, capital E-Y-E. And FireEye is a publicly listed $3 billion cybersecurity firm that was started about 14 years ago. It's based here in Silicon Valley in Milpitas, California. It has emerged as a prominent provider of investigative services for high-profile cyber attacks. And a major aspect of their present-day operations is government contracts for network security at the state and federal level. And they have also been hired by the people who are trying to scrub social media from weaponized Russian messaging. And I've linked to this article so you can read all of the details. But it says here, the censoring of social media accounts by Twitter, Facebook, and Google was based primarily upon information provided to them by FireEye. On August 23rd, FireEye published a 38-page report titled Suspected Iranian Influence Operation. Now, the Iranians had linked to left-wing views and political positions being voiced in American media and in posts on social media. And there's no indication here that they equally treated right-wing platforms, media outlets, and voices. So it's clear to me that Trump is on to something here, and I don't want to dismiss it out of hand. But he's got the wrong victims. And any resolution, any type of regulation that he proposes, I think will violate the First Amendment and likely be used to stamp out more voices from the left and not the right. And over at Facebook, Trump's little Twitter tantrum has led to the surfacing of a group of conservatives, FBers, for political diversity. This popped up just in the last couple of days. Brian Americh, a senior Facebook engineer, said that we claim to welcome all perspectives, but are quick to attack, often in mobs, anyone who presents a view that appears to be in opposition to left-leaning ideology. Facebook has 25,000 employees, and I don't expect that they are all like-minded politically. But how do they carry out their duties in trying to balance free speech rights with lies and disinformation? Well, it's a thorny task. There is simply no doubt about that. But the pressure coming from Trump and from Washington is unlikely to produce a free speech result. The Democratic National Committee met last week in Chicago, and they modified the rules about the role of superdelegates in the 2020 nominating convention. And my friend Norman Solomon, who together with Karen Bernal and other progressive activists in the Democratic Party have been pressing the DNC, well, they declared victory. Solomon writes, "Officials rarely decide to reduce their own power, and the Democratic Party has not made such a historic reform to its nominating process in decades." And all they did was say the superdelegates don't get to vote on the first ballot. Now, that does make a difference. It is significant. And Norman jumps from that to saying that the takeaways are that leadership to make historic change has to come from the grassroots, that even the best Democrats in Congress aren't providing much cutting-edge leadership. He's right about that. That election campaigns should be subsets of social movements and not the other way around. I'm with you there, Norman. And he offers this cautionary note. At the same time, progressives should not defer to leadership from Democratic Party officials or congressional Democrats who are routinely constrained and compromised by their roles. And in a time of perpetual war and runaway militarism, in sync with rampant corporate power, the party is currently in need of a basic course correction that can only come from the grassroots. Now, I'm with Norman on this. But I received an email, I'm sorry I don't have a way to link to this, but from Carol Earl, or Early, who is the communications person for the People's Party. And here is a succinct one-paragraph critique. The DNC took several steps to expand and consolidate its power over the 2020 presidential primary at its summer meeting in Chicago this weekend. They reduced caucuses, which heavily favored Sanders in 2016, and replaced them with primaries. It rebuked progressive demands to eliminate superdelegates, moving them to the second round of voting at the nominating convention instead. It preserved the use of joint fundraising agreements, which Hillary used to launder money to her campaign and take over the DNC. It approved a rule allowing the DNC to block candidates who've not been faithful Democrats from running. It kept nearly 100 lobbyists on the DNC, and it did nothing to extricate corporate and billionaire money from the party, preserving rampant corruption. Well, you can decide if this was a progressive victory. And speaking of the DNC, as I've noted, it pains me to see the allegations against Keith Ellison, who is leaving Congress. He's running for attorney general in his home state of Minnesota. And just before the primary, his former girlfriend, Karen Monahan, went public and accused him of emotional abuse. And she has now fine-tuned that to a term that doesn't exist in psychology or psychiatry called narcissist abuse. And I can understand what she's driving at. She describes it as a suffering experienced by partners of self-centered people. Now, this gets into the the weeds of personal relationships. And Monahan writes, or she told an interviewer recently, narcissist abuse is very difficult to understand. It's the gaslighting, the habitual lying, the making it seem like it was my fault for even asking why something happened. She accuses Ellison of routinely being unfaithful, and I can't evaluate that. Former wife of Keith Ellison, Kim Ellison, said that they remain close. She's never seen him behave abusively. And Monahan had moved in with Ellison and his teenage daughter for a couple of years. Her name is Amira, and she posted on Facebook that Monahan quickly became actively territorial and threatening towards me. And she says many people believe Karen. That reality both gives me hope for the beautiful momentum of the Me Too movement and a profound anger at the injustice of these false accusations. Karen Monahan is exploiting a movement. So, I cannot reach any Solomon-like decision here. I don't have enough information. I don't know the parties. I don't know if Monahan is credible. But it seems like they had a bad relationship that ended badly. Thank you, Chloe, for piping up. And this gets into territory that's very difficult for the general public to evaluate. And I don't know if it will cost the election of Attorney General for Keith Ellison coming up in November. Well, our narcissist in chief, that's a mouthful, Trump, the other day fired his White House counsel, who had announced he was going to leave but hadn't actually put the resignation in the hopper. And Don McGahn found out on Twitter that the gig is up. And people speculate that Trump just didn't like to see that, the White House counsel was getting as much coverage as Trump these days after we learned that McGahn spent some 30 hours talking to investigators for Bob Mueller. So today, Trump compounded this by taking to Twitter again. He has not announced the replacement for McGahn, but he tweeted about it anyway. I am very excited about the person who will be taking the place of Don McGahn as White House counsel. I like Don, but he was not responsible for me not firing Bob Mueller or Jeff Sessions. So much fake reporting and fake news. Well, once we get past the double negatives there, Trump appears to be admitting that other people talked him out of firing Bob Mueller and or Jeff Sessions. And this is the way the Twitter tweets these days in Washington. And we're learning more about the context of the tape that was released by Michael Cohen before he entered his guilty plea. And that tape was of him having a kind of curious conversation with Trump about how to deal with the National Enquirer. And initially, we thought it was limited to the catch and kill of Karen McDougal, the playmate who said she had an affair with Trump, of her story. But today, the New York Times reports that the Enquirer had a whole vault filled with dirt on Trump that they had collected over all the way back to the 1980s. And what Trump and Cohen were actually talking about in their kind of coded way was paying off David Pecker at the National Enquirer to release back to Trump all the dirt that they had collected so it could be buried. And this appears to be why prosecutors have provided partial immunity to David Pecker. And this just continues to get deeper and deeper and more bizarre. And once again, I renew my demand that political leaders, particularly the Democrats, call for Donald Trump's resignation. They're afraid of impeachment. They won't touch it, they say, until after the election. And as I've pointed out, that is a senseless posturing. And I think that it's pretty safe for the Democrats to call for his resignation. He's probably not going to do it soon. But that's something that some Republicans could hop onto as well. And it just baffles me how the denial on both sides, the Republicans who claim that, well, you know, this isn't serious enough to talk about impeachment, and the Democrats who say, oh, we're not planning to impeach this guy. I mean, nobody believes either one of those positions. And Trump's threats at the media, which he has called the enemy of the people, have produced a kind of copycat effect. The FBI reporting today it has charged a California man from Encino near Los Angeles who threatened to kill people at the Boston Globe after calling them the enemy of the people in a series of menacing phone calls. A guy named Robert Chain, age 68, was arrested. He had some firearms, and he made repeated calls to the Boston Globe after the paper announced on August 10th that it would publish a coordinated editorial response to political attacks on the media. In one call to the newsroom, Chain threatened to shoot the newspaper's employees in the head. 3 days later, Chain said, "You're the enemy of the people." And using profane language, not quoted here, he threatened to kill every Globe employee. Well, this is the tangible impact of Trump's reckless and really dangerous public commentary and the way he typifies the media. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. And today I want to single out Alex Marin. She lives in Surprise, Arizona. And she just got a new job, and she decided to share her wealth a little bit. Sent a check for $100 to the Peter B. Collins Podcast, and I really appreciate that, Alex. She made some other comments here, but I don't think that they are for general consumption. She is, however, a very loyal supporter of this podcast. She said about me, "You are the ultimate truth teller. Your humor and insight enables me to remain sane in this horrifically insane world. Thank you so much. Signed, Alex, your devoted fan forever." Wow. Thank you, Alex. You make my heart go a little faster. Glenn Greenwald has been remarkably silent about the Russiagate narrative in his critical commentary of it for several months now. And he broke that silence on the 28th. That would have been Tuesday. And he took on CNN. And this gets a little complicated. Michael Cohen, as you know, has an attorney, a Democratic lawyer named Lanny Davis. And after the plea deal, when Michael Cohen went into court and pled guilty with some detail and named Trump on two of the campaign finance charges, his attorney, Lanny Davis, went on both Rachel Maddow's show and on CNN and said that Michael Cohen might have information that Bob Mueller would be interested in. And when he was pressed, he said that, well, he witnessed a conversation that Trump knew about, the Trump Tower meeting with Veselnitskaya and the other Russians before it happened, which, of course, he has denied. So it turns out that report is false. And at first, CNN reported it using Cohen as an anonymous source. And then when he walked it back, CNN did not join the Washington Post and New York Post, who outed Davis as their anonymous sources and retracted their stories. And so Glenn Greenwald correctly is calling on CNN to issue a retraction and to correct the record. And he goes on to add that in another sequence on, last week, CNN put Lanny Davis on the air with Anderson Cooper to deny that he was the source for the CNN story, a denial that Cooper didn't contest, But Davis now admits that he was one of those sources and that it was false. Yet, says Greenwald, CNN in its July 26 story specifically claimed that Davis refused to talk to CNN about the story or provide any comment whatsoever. So the timelines here are a little jumbled. But he makes a good point that CNN and other outlets dismiss his challenges to their bad reporting, and they call it media criticism. You know, like somebody who said, oh, I don't like Anderson Cooper's hair. But he says, look, documenting false claims from powerful corporate media outlets or describing their wrongful behavior is real reporting. It's not media criticism. And he goes on, I've linked to his article here. He lists about 10 or 11 conflicts in the official narrative reported by the Washington Post, The Guardian, Slate, Fortune, CNN, that remain either uncorrected or any corrections were kind of whispered and not reported full-throated. Over at Consortium News, my colleague Gareth Porter has a great piece. It's a long read. I've linked to it. What he shows is that the Department of Homeland Security created a deceptive, hyped narrative of Russian attempts to hack American voter sites in various states. And he goes through it in a detailed manner and shows that the Department of Homeland Security appears to be trying to compete with the CIA and the NSA in showing that, yeah, we can discover Russian perfidy as well. And so Porter goes through the claims that the Illinois voter registration website was hacked, that Arizona suffered a serious hack, and there are other cases cited as well, including, one in Ohio. So this is an important balancing act to the reckless and, the media malpractice that I have commented on in so many cases. And Porter writes that despite embarrassing admissions, DHS gave a statement last year that they stood by their assessment that 21 states were the target of Russian government cyber actors. But the claims that they actually succeeded appear to be unproven at this date. So I recommend you read that. Also at Consortium News, there's another VIPS open memo, this one to the media, and it is not signed by every member of VIPS, I'll note that, but they make a good case that John Brennan's hand-wringing over Trump's very political, dirty trick of pulling his security clearance is offset by the long history of John Brennan, and that no former CIA director is entitled, as a matter of law, to maintain a security clearance. And while I continue to deplore the way Trump did this, it was Nixonian, the fact is he has the right to do it, and Brennan is a guy with a very checkered past. Now, while we're talking about Nixons, Cynthia Nixon, the lesbian actress who used to be on Sex and the City, she's challenging Andrew Cuomo for the Democratic nomination for governor of New York. They had their single debate on television last night. I got to watch about a half hour of it. And Cynthia Nixon comes across as solid. There were a few points where she dodged questions about her lack of political experience and how she would get laws passed in Albany. But she was very effective in challenging Cuomo. And she would interrupt him, peppered him with questions. And at one point he said, can you stop interrupting? She said, can you stop lying? And then in a neener neener teenage response, Cuomo said, as soon as you do. Well, I didn't catch Cynthia Nixon in any lies last night. But she did nail Cuomo. Quote, I'm not an Albany insider like Governor Cuomo, but experience doesn't mean that much if you're not actually good at governing. He did take a pledge not to run for president in 2020. And overall, I think Cynthia Nixon did a great job in presenting her challenges to a guy who I think is devious and somewhat corrupt. I'm not sure how deeply corrupt, but people around him are corrupt, and he hasn't done much to fix that. Now, before all this, Governor Cuomo, about a week and a half ago, signed a bill into law that I support. It creates a new prosecutorial misconduct commission in the state of New York. And it is a breakthrough. It's something that I feel very strongly about. But as he signed it into law, he said that he wants it to be amended. That shows that this was a political statement on his part, and it's driven by the challenge of Cynthia Nixon. So I support in principle the governor's support in principle of this new bill. But we don't know how he plans to amend it, and that is problematic. There is going to be a new judge presiding over the kangaroo court at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. His name is Keith Perella. He replaces Army Colonel James Pohl, who has announced his retirement. And Pohl did that just after he announced a very controversial ruling where, on August 17th, he ordered the exclusion of interrogations by the FBI of the alleged 9/11 conspirators, most that were conducted after their transfer from the black sites to the Guantanamo base in Cuba. That is very controversial, and we are still awaiting resolution of the decision back in February by Defense Secretary Mad Dog Mattis to sack the convening authority of the military commission's Harvey Ryshikoff, because it appears that at the time Ryshikoff was exploring plea deals, and if Mattis fired him to prevent that, well, that's unconstitutional. But who cares? You know, it's Guantanamo. We know those guys are guilty. We're just waiting for the process to confirm it for us. The Catholic Church is facing a very serious schism. The far-right, homophobic priesthood and bishoprics have challenged Pope Francis. And the guy who led the call here is Carlo Maria Vigano, a former Vatican leader. He was once the papal nuncio to the United States. He is a very hardline conservative who opposes Pope Francis, and he has alleged that Francis knew about the sex crimes of Cardinal Ted McCarrick, the former Archbishop of Washington, 5 years before he accepted his resignation. Now, that is a powerful charge. We have to remember that the Pope before Francis, Benedict, better known as Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, he presided over the real cover-up of the sins of the priest, the crimes against young people, boys and girls. And so this has been going on for a long time. And this is a very strategic maneuver on the part of the most conservative clerics in the Catholic Church. But Francis is in a bind. If it can be proven that he knew about it and didn't act, it could produce another papal resignation. Finally today, we've told you about the spies running for Congress as Democrats this year, and one of them, Abigail Spanberger, running in suburban Washington in Virginia, has a real leg up now because she is able to share her outrage that one of her files that was used to win her security clearance was somehow obtained by the Postal Service. And then they released it. A Postal Service spokesman said, "We take full responsibility for this unfortunate error. We've taken immediate steps to ensure that it won't happen again. We believe the issue began in June of 18 and that only a small number of additional requests for information from personnel files were improperly processed." So this is a big blunder, but the explanation does not satisfy the former spook. Spanberger said there's no legal way they could have gotten this fully unredacted SF-86, referring to the file. And the next question, what does it mean they're actually pushing it around? What do I have to hide? Absolutely nothing. But her outrage will probably serve her well in this political campaign. Thanks for listening to my Daily News and Comment podcast. I hope to get it posted here shortly. I've got a few technical problems to overcome. Thanks for listening. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy happy trails.